on the kind of constraints you have to impose. First, if you have any theory, you can define the symplectic structure. For example, for the scalar field, you have the Klein-Gordon norm. And if you take two perturbations around some background, and you evaluate the symplectic structure on some hypersurface going up to infinity, it has to be finite for the mode to be admissible. So if this condition is satisfied, we'll call the modes normalizable, which means that it corresponds to finite variation of the action if you vary some configuration to some other configuration satisfying this condition. There are other conditions that are important for perturbation to be admissible. One of them is also that you don't want the symplectic structure to be non-zero at the boundary. So if you take the normal component of it, it has to be zero at the boundary, since you don't want the in some sense the you want the you want the probability to stay inside of the boundary, so you don't want to that the flux the flux goes outside of the boundary, so it's related to the unitarity of the boundary theory. You want the symplectic structure to be conserved. And there is one last condition that is important. You don't want to have ghosts in the theory, so if you complexify and you look at positive frequency mode, where you define some time evolution, where the norm of this perturbation has to be positive. So all these are usual requirements for perturbations. So so our variation of the boundary gravity, do they satisfy all these requirements? So to take some inspiration first, I will just review what we know about the scalar field. So if you take just in antidecidor space, the Klein-Gordon equation, and you know that there are two independent solutions of it, one falling very quickly, one falling more slowly at the boundary. And if the mass is big enough, bigger than some negative value in dimension D, then it is known that only one mode is admissible. And the other one way to see that it's not admissible is that the operator that is dual to this field have a dimension below the unitarity bound. So you can, if you vary it, you will in general lead to ghost in the boundary theory. So you are led in the bulk to impose this boundary condition that the slowly falling mode has to be fixed. And it's called Dirichlet boundary conditions. And the interesting case, as described by Brayton, Nolan, and Friedman, in some mass range, both modes become interesting. So they both are normalizable and in the unitarity range. So you're allowed to have more boundary conditions. And you still need to have this conservation condition. So you can vary both of them. You have to fix either the other one or having some relation between the two fields, A and B, by introducing some functional W. So these are the kind of boundary conditions that you can have. And well, if the mass is too negative, then you have instability. And there is a natural interpretation of all these kind of boundary conditions in the CFT as deformation of the CFT. Well, come back to that. So this was for the spin zero particle. So you can do it also for spin one. And you find also this kind of boundary condition for massless spin one particles. You also, in some sense, you are in this range. You can have two kind of boundary conditions for the U1 gauge field. So is it the case also for gravity? So the first condition is the normalizability. So if you take some fluctuation of G0 and you compute using the Einstein-Hilbert action, you can ask any question if you want. By the way, so yes.
So just to make sure, so you're studying the spin one thing, you're always in that range, or
So it's a massless, so you don't have one tunable parameter, but you also have two kind of boundary conditions, fixing the electric field or the magnetic field at the boundary. Well, magnetic and electric means with respect to the normal, to radial coordinate.
So what's the precise here? Are you claiming that the spin one case, you have both boundary conditions in all dimensions, or are you looking at the ABS-4 case in particular?
If I think four dimensions, if I think four, only four dimensions, yes. Yes. Good remark. So here I'm concerned really for the graviton D dimension. Yes, that's indeed. Yeah, otherwise you cannot, you don't know what is the electric field or magnetic field in higher dimensions. It's not so, okay. So if you take now the usual inner product, so you start with the Einstein-Hilbert action, you compute the sampling structure from this Einstein-Hilbert action, you find that the fluctuations are are infinite. They correspond to infinite variation, even for the simple cases. So it seems that you cannot do anything. However, there is one lesson that we have learned, is if you want to make sense of the bulk in ABS-CFT, you have to renormalize it. So you have infinite quantities. If you want to make sense of the stress tensor, for example, you need to add counterterms to the action. So if you start with only Einstein-Hilbert plus cosmological constant, you add Gibbons-Hawking terms such that the variation of the bulk only depends on the induced metric at the space-like boundary. And then you have an infinite result, so you need to add a minimal subtraction of all these divergences. And at the end, the variation of the bulk will just be a finite result, and you can read off the stress tensor with that expression. So you need to do this renormalization in order to identify the stress tensor. But now, if you want to consider G0 to really be a dynamical field, these counterterms contain time derivative of G0. So they will this action will enter into the dynamics. It will contribute to the momentum and therefore to the symplectic structure. If you are familiar with the phase space methods, you know that the symplectic structure for Einstein gravity is usually ambiguous up to a boundary term, which is classically unfixed. And here there is a prescription to fix it, because we know that to regularize the action, we add this boundary term. So there is a way to add a specific boundary term related to this counterterm to define this symplectic structure. And in using that one, all modes of fluctuation become normalizable. All infinities cancel between the two. So we have checked that for 2, 3, and 4 dimensions, but we expect that it's true in any dimension, just because the algebraic complexity grows with the dimension. There are more and more counterterms. It's less and less easy to keep track of everything, but it seems to be straightforward to extend it.
And 2, 3, and 4
is boundary dimensions, yes. So there was already a sign that this is true in ADS 4, because there was some analysis of Fijibashi and Wald showing that linear perturbation around ADS, they did all the cases. They studied for the spin 2 field, and they found that you have this kind of two self-adjoint extension for the spin 2 field around ADS 4. So you have these two boundary conditions, but it was limited to 4 dimensions. And here we found that it's true in any dimension. And well, we can discuss why exactly. There was no contradiction between the two. They couldn't find these extensions because the counterterms involve higher derivatives of the boundary metric. And there were also some previous remarks in these references.
Okay. So I'm a little bit lost in terms of what. I mean, I thought from the title that you were basically going to integrate over metrics on the boundary.
Yeah.
And that seems like it's something that should be allowed to do.
So they define some inner products, which is very natural for linear perturbation around ADS. which they reduce everything in harmonics, and then they use the usual inner product for these harmonics. And it's not very clear how it's related to the sampling structure, for instance, gravity plus counter terms or thing like that. So at the end of the analysis, it seems clear that the one that they used is can be translated into these terms with the contribution of the counter terms. Otherwise, it would be inconsistent. So this was the technical point. Yes.
So the normalized issue of both is a statement about R
dependence. The R, yes. So
the R dependence is clearly determined by equation of motion, local equation of motion inside area.
So it's more than just the R dependence. We'll know how they fall off, but we don't know if they make sense, if they correspond to some finite variation of the action, for example, or if we need an inner product between the modes. So we need more. Yeah, and there is this definition is really unique once you define these counter terms, and it fixes the usual ambiguity, so the natural. And the sampling structure has still to be conserved. So you remember the fact that it has to be conserved led to these two kind of boundary conditions. In the scalar field case, we cannot vary anything. So the analog here is either to fix the zero as usual, or fix Tij, or having some combination of the two with some additional ingredient, which is some boundary dynamics for gravity. So that's nice interpretation. So if you plug this this boundary condition in the result we just had here, it's an exact variation. So you can put it on the left hand side if you want. These boundary conditions really correspond to some variational principle where you add a boundary dynamics for the gravity. Yes.
So in the scalar case, when you do this, if you look at the next one, it corresponds to adding a term to the action, which is some multi-trace term, which is polynomial.
Yes.
So if you want to add an Einstein action, which is not polynomial, you're adding something which is not polynomial.
Yes, that's right. Why not? But it will still correspond, I will explain in the CFT, adding these terms would still correspond to relevant deformations, in the same sense that adding this multi-trace deformation is some deformation of the CFT. This will also correspond to some deformation of the boundary theory.
You can regard these multi-trace deformations in the sense that the natural way to think about these deformations is, of course, to add a function or metric. But you can also do it by kind of reversing the process of, once you have that boundary equation motion, metric is linked to the stress tensor, then the sense in which this is the same as adding a function of the stress tensor. If you think of it as adding a function of the stress tensor to the original CFT, it's an irrelevant deformation, a non-relevant one, or something that's a different stress tensor. But Jeffrey will set up a setting in which you can call these things relevant deformations of some other thing, which is the same kind of thing that you see in the scalar case. When you add a potential, it's always a relevant deformation of the
Neumann theory.
With the slow fall off, and it's always an irrelevant deformation of the theory of the fast fall off that you might have thought you wanted to start with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so against the first part, so we have different alternative boundary conditions, and so this one or this one, and what can we learn about these theories? So I will try to motivate the idea that the natural correspondence is this gravity induced at the boundary. Then we talk about this relevant deformation we already talked about, and I will indicate some checks that this is consistent, and then I will explain in different dimensions what these theories are like.
So the boundary theory now has dynamical gravity?
Yes. Yes, correct.
And you're going to say this was a consistent boundary theory?
Well, this is the check here that at least these theories are conformally invariant, and in all dimensions. So this no. Well, I don't know. Here is the large n is only the large n limits because the in the bulk we just look at Einstein just supergravity. So everything is the large n limit. And we so we don't know if this theory really exists.
It's a dual formulation of construction. You can use the ADS rule to investigate whether the boundary theory is well defined in the way symbols. And at leading order and margin, there are no problems other than the ones that you mentioned.
Yeah, we will relax this constraint very soon. So what is the induced gravity? So you take any CFT, so n equals 4 super Young Mills, let's say, or any one you like, and you replace the flat metric by a gravitational field. So you couple it to the gravity or to a multiplet if you want to conserve supersymmetry. And now you evaluate this partition function, it will be some function of G0 of the metric, and you can rewrite it like this. So you define an effective action for G0. So you haven't introduced any kinetic term for the metric. You just, because the graviton appears in the loops, it will lead to some effective theory. So now the induced gravity partition function is defined by integrating over all possible G0s. So there are general results on this induced gravity theories. One of them is that if you write G0 like this, so you factor this conformal factor and you write some fiducial metric, this one, and you plug that into the integral, for all dimensions, it is known that there are no trace anomalies. So the integral will be independent of this conformal factor. And if you start with a CFT, the induced gravity will be also conformal. In even dimension, in general, there is a trace anomaly, so the induced gravity will not be conformal, and we have this trace anomaly. So now the correspondence here is pretty clear. You have the usual partition function for ADS, so supergravity, and you allow G0 to be arbitrary, and you allow it to fluctuate in the path integral. And this defines the partition function in the bulk. And the claim is that it seems reasonable to associate these two partition functions, to equate them. If you do that, then in the bulk, if you look at saddle points of this of the action in the bulk, you will see, well, we are in the semi-classical limits. We just have the equation of motion in the bulk, and we've seen that we have this boundary term. But now, if G0 is allowed to vary, the saddle point will be obtained only when Tij is zero. So this Tij zero is this constraint is really the condition to have a semi-classical limit of this path integral.
Yeah.
Yes.
Above, which is what I usually thought was
fixed.
Yeah. And
yes.
Exactly.
What constraint?
And this follows from the semi-classical limit now. Yeah.
But that's the model you didn't fix before, right? I mean, so it's not that separately. But you
generate
over metrics.
Yeah.
Never managed to fix the same thing. Which is a change in
So you vary both of them. You vary everything, and then as a semi-classical limit, you get that equation of motion. That's just a semi-classical. Yes, just a semi-classical limit. So and the deformation of the theory. So the interpretation for this deformation now. So the stress tensor has mass dimension d. So what is the dimension of G0? If you just look at the Pfeffer-Langevin expansion, there are d coefficient of the radius. So the dimension of G0 is 0. If you want to have a relevant deformation, you need to add a term which has less than mass dimension less than or equal to d. So it will be, it means less than d derivatives. Because g0 is just dimension 0. So all the masses come from the derivatives. So you can list them. You have a finite number of possible deformation, relevant deformation of these theories. In two dimensions, it's just the cosmological constant and Einstein. In three, you have also three derivatives that are allowed. So I rewrite them in terms of this Pontryagin form in four dimensions, which will use your boundary term, the three derivatives. And in four dimensions, you have additional terms, these quadratic terms. So if you add these deformations both at the bulk and at the boundary, they will imply, in the saddle point approximation, the semi-classical approximation, that will imply this equation at the boundary. So now, up to here, it's pure conjecture. There was no result. There are no results, really. So let's do some checks. So let's assume just for a moment that the boundary has usual topology. It will be simpler. So if you, one thing that one should check is that if the symmetries are the same on both sides of the equivalence. Well, here, the symmetries are more gauge freedom. We have a gravity theory at the boundary, so we would like to have a diffeomorphism, as all diffeomorphisms should be pure gauge at the boundary, which is very different from the usual ADS-CFT, where you have the conformal group at the boundary. Here, I would like to have all diffeomorphisms should be pure gauge. So is it the case? And yes, it is. If you take a diffeomorphism in the bulk that corresponds to a diffeomorphism at the boundary, so they induce some diffeomorphism at the boundary, it's a very special bulk diffeomorphism. And you look at the symplectic structure, you evaluate it on this direction along this the lead derivative of this diffeomorphism. So the interpretation of this is the conserved charge associated to this vector field. And you can check that with the definition of the symplectic structure, everything cancels and the charges are really zero. So it means these vector fields are degenerate direction of the symplectic structure, which is the definition of a gauge symmetry. So all diffeomorphisms are really gauge transformations. And you can apply the same reasoning in all dimensions for the diffeomorphism that you use this Weyl transformation of the boundary, this Weyl rescaling. They scale T and G0 that way. And you can also check that they correspond to charges that are all zero. For any possible, for any possible Lagrangian that you can build like this, the charges are always zero. The term really cancel. So that's one point, that at least we have a gravity theory because we have a diffeomorphic invariance and we have a dynamical metric. Yes. So, so in three dimension, you mean three dimension in the boundary or in the bulk? Three dimension in the boundary. So this theory, yes. So here, if I add these terms, this term will break the conformal invariance of the boundary. You're completely right. So if I don't include that term, I have the Neumann boundary condition, the one where you don't add additional dynamics, you just leave the metric fluctuate, and you have a conformal theory. And if you add these terms, you will break the conformal invariance, but you will keep the diffeomorphism invariance. You will still have. So because you break them, you cannot these vector fields, you cannot consider them anymore. So now let's look case by case. So in two dimension, everything is very simple. Because any CFT has a trace anomaly, and you can just integrate the trace anomaly to find the effective action. And the effective action is always the Polyakov action. And if you introduce some new Weyl invariance by decomposing the metric like this, the Polyakov action just becomes the Liouville theory for this conformal factor. And so so the theory really that you obtain at the boundary is the original CFT coupled to this Liouville gravity. And how to see that that you obtain really this theory is a bit non-trivial. You start with the Einstein term in three dimensions. You add these counter terms, and you evaluate it on shell for this for the metric, the bulk metric, evaluated in terms of the boundary metric. And you find that the Einstein-Hilbert action on shell reduced to a boundary term, which is exactly the Polyakov action. Yes?
So is this related to the work where people try to sort of look at pure gravity in 2+1 dimensions and say that it's dual to the Liouville theory on the boundary?
No. So this is different. So, okay.
All the same words.
All the same words, but it's okay, so it's very confusing. I completely agree. It's completely confused. I was completely confused at the beginning with that. So this work of Kusar, I know. So they describe anti-de-Sitter boundary conditions. So the metric at the boundary is fixed. It's a flat metric at the boundary, or the metric of this on the sphere. And they look at perturbation of this normalizable mode, this mode inside, and they find that the action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, really reduced to a Liouville action for these modes. And these modes are really the dynamics of the stress tensor. That the stress tensor is at some Liouville, it's really the stress tensor from Liouville field. And so this Liouville theory describes the dynamics of the stress tensor. So it's another Liouville theory than this one. This Liouville theory is a Liouville theory of the conformal factor of the boundary metric. And so in their work, it's really the Dirichlet boundary conditions, the one where you fix the metric. Here, this Liouville field is put to zero because you put the stress tensor to zero. This Liouville field vanish. And in place, you have the other Liouville field, this one, and which describes this, exactly the same equation, but with a different meaning. And there is no way to excite them at the same time, just with these boundary conditions. There is some connection like this in D equals three dimensions. I don't know, in some sense, yeah, I don't know. Maybe there is more structure to discover. But I don't know in what sense it would be a duality. In some sense, you exchange G0 and Tij. I will have more to say in three dimensions, I don't wonder. So this equation of motion, if you express it in that gauge, it's really reduced to the Liouville equation. So it doesn't seem like, but it's true.
Yeah. You can write an equation which is the same for both the normalized theory and the pure theory, but the same equation corresponds to different bulk solutions in each case. There's a one-to-one now.
The
bulk
theory kills
it.
Yeah. That doesn't include the IT, but. So in higher dimensions, it's more complicated, of course. If you know the boundary metric, and you try to reconstruct the bulk metric, the Pfeffer-Mangram expansion, you don't know where you don't know how to continue it inside, deep inside. So you don't know the general solution of Einstein equation in higher than three dimensions. That's exactly the claim. So you cannot compute the on-shell action to try to find what is the boundary theory. From the bulk, it's hard to know exactly what is the boundary theory. And from the CFT point of view, we don't know all CFTs dual to the ADS geometries first, and moreover, even the one that we know, we don't know what is their effective action. So, in order to construct this dictionary, what we have done is just a perturbative analysis around flat space. So we just consider linear perturbation around the G0 being flat. So we look at ADS in Poincaré coordinates, and we try to do the mapping between the two theories. So here was Huguette. So using the bulk, computing this correlator of the graviton in the boundary using this correspondence. So you can do it, and you obtain these results written in Fourier space. So the propagator has some tensor structure, transverse traceless. And you observe D is odd here, so you have a square root of the momentum. And here you have a log. So this propagator have a branch cut, which means you have bound states, you have a continuum spectrum of masses ranging from zero to infinity. So the graviton is not a massless particle. It's more So this theory really have some continuous spectrum of masses. And one beautiful thing you can see is if you compute the symplectic structure on two such perturbations, you compute the norm of them using the symplectic structure, you find that they are ghost-free. So they are positive. They have positive norm. So this theory is not sick at all. It's really around flat space, we have nice perturbations. Nice. Yes.
So this is the induced gravity. This is
without any extra dynamics. So this theory is conformal because from the bulk perspective we have this vial with scaling that are completely gauge freedom. So it has the form of a conformal propagator in a conformal theory, and around flat space the spectrum is ghost free. It seems to be a very good theory. Yes, even though in some sense they combine in a very nice way, because these higher derivatives interpreted in the bulk, they are just two derivatives in the bulk. If you interpret it from the bulk, everything goes fine and the norm is positive. And from the boundary perspective, it's not easy to obtain. You really have to go to the bulk to do computation. Yes. So this theory is very, very different from conformal gravity. So this theory, this propagator, you can rewrite it like this. I mean, you just invert it and you have this effective action. So it's really, there are an infinite number of derivatives, really. So conformal gravity would be a very small part of it if you want, but it's really not the main dynamics. You have an infinite number of terms that combine together.
It has every mass.
Yes. So
normally, in a conformal theory, you have no mass.
So
this one, basically, by having every mass.
Mm-hmm.
Every
mass. That's a good remark.
Yeah. Normal conformal theory. Well, but basically, a equals 4s,
it also has a brain of arbitrary mass.
That's
the analog.
Okay, this is more like that one. Yeah. Okay.
It's more like bond state. Yeah. So I just go back here. Here you have a logarithm, and the problem is you have also a pole at k equals 1 over L, where L is related to the radius of antidesita. And this mode is tachyonic. So that mode is a problem. It's an instability of flat space in four dimensions, which is also ghost-like. I mentioned just one non-trivial check of this formula. In ADS5, there should be a link with n equals 4 super Young Mills. So this quadratic term can be really obtained by the effective action of n equals 4 super Young Mills. And there is a precise matching with the normalization coefficient that was obtained already by Yud Seitling. That's not new, but shows that there is really a match. Yes, so they conjecture that what they did really, if you take super Young Mills, you couple it to the graviton, then if you renormalize it at one loop, you will find there is a logarithmic divergence, and the effective action at this logarithmic divergence is the conformal supergravity, and here, well, it's very hard to explain. So at one loop, the result should be exact at all loops because of the property of super MAs. So also a strong coupling. So in the supergravity side, you can see this conformal supergravity. And in our case, we subtracted all divergences, so also this log divergence. And what is remaining is just some remnant from that. So there is a finite contribution also coming from it, and it's exactly that one at the quadratic order. So this one is a Weyl, just a Weyl tensor.
There is a CD,
some coefficient. It's just some coefficient that depends on L squared over G. So in two dimensions, everything is clear. It's only the polyhedric of action. In higher dimension, so this is for the pure Neumann theory where we have any deformation. So in any other dimension, it's like this. It seems to be very, very well behaved. So it's interesting to look at the next interesting case, which is three dimension where we have deformation. So we would like to. This theory is very weird because there are all these infinite derivatives. We don't know exactly how it looks like. So if we deform it in the infrared, we change the infrared behavior, but we keep the good UV properties, this conformal invariance. So we have a theory that looks like cosmological constant plus Einstein in the infrared and with these good properties in the UV. So that's the idea. So we introduce some parameters. So the most general relevant deformation in the Villeneuve metric is this one. And I will not consider the cosmological constant because I want the metric to stay flat at the boundary, always looking at the Poincaré patch only. So I will not introduce that term. So we just introduce G, the Newton constant of the boundary, and lambda. These two terms together are called topologically massive gravity. And you compute the propagator, and you get something more complicated. It's not very enlightening. So in place of looking at that, I will draw some diagrams. Just look, there are two tensor structures because that one is parity invariant, parity violating. So there are some epsilon inside of this one. We have some ghosts here, but there is no, it's only the Euclidean propagator that you get it, and there is no mode in the Lorentzian sector that correspond to it. So you can forget about it. Yes, around flat space at the boundary, so which corresponds to ADS in the dark. If you have flat, yes. So I put lambda to zero. I put lambda to zero. So only GB and lambda are different. So just to set the ideas, so in topologically massive gravity, so if you forget everything about the bulk, just in three dimensions, we have this model by Desert, Jakif, and Templeton, and the spectrum of the theory is only one massive spin 2 particle. So that's the classical result. Only Einstein gravity in three dimensions, you know, it's trivial. There is no propagating degree of freedom. But if you couple it to this topological term, there is a degree of freedom that is emerging. And it's a massive spin 2 particle. And it goes free when the Newton constant is negative, which is a bit weird. But you have these derivatives, these three derivatives anyway, so it may be weird. And now, so if you turn on all these constants, what you get is this nice picture. So you still have a square root, so you have a branch cut, which corresponds to all these continuum spectrum of bound states, or I don't know how to call them. And you can check that there are no tachyons and no ghosts, also only with that condition that the Newton constant is negative. So it's a well-behaved theory, which looks like Einstein gravity in the infrared, and which has this nice conformal invariance property in the UV.
Like Einstein gravity in 2 plus 1 dimension.
Yes, in 2 plus 1 dimension, at the boundary. negative Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. And there is a tachyon in the other case, so we don't want that. Just maybe a note for Sean, then five time. So there is some notion of electromagnetic duality in three boundary dimensions on ADS4. So if you just introduce this topological term, this lambda, there is some cool interpretation. So if lambda is zero, you have this Neumann theory that I described before. So the boundary metric can fluctuate, and Tij is fixed. Tij, actually, you can, in that case, it's really the electric part of the white tensor of the bulk. So the electric part of the white tensor is fixed. And if you put lambda to infinity, you will fix really the magnetic part of the white tensor. And it really amounts to fixing G0 because everything is component invariant and diffeomorphism invariant. This is the Cotan tensor, very specific in three dimensions. Anyway, and then the value is self-dual for some specific values of lambda. So we have some framework to look at electromagnetic duality playing with these objects. For the electromagnetic duality in the sense of for the spin-2 field, really for gravity. So I conclude. The counter terms save the day in the standard structure. So these fluctuations are really normalizable. So as a consequence, you have these new boundary conditions that you can impose if you want. And I motivated the idea that they are really they correspond in the CFT, in the dual CFT, to an induced gravity model, which is conformal in D dimension, in odd boundary dimensions. You can deform it also by these relevant deformations. It's a non-local theory of gravity, not easy to handle, but you have some control in the UV, and the spectrum is ghost and tachyon free in all dimensions around flat space. Some more results in the four dimension, where also coupling to this topological maximum gravity, the spectrum is still nice, and you have some interpretations. And then to conclude, some direction for the future. This case is very interesting, ADS4 cross S7, because if you take the supergravity multiplet of n equals 8, all the scalar fields are in the greater Noether Freeman range. The mass is really in between, so it seems consistent to turn the other boundary condition for the entire multiplet. And so to preserve supersymmetry while doing this weird change of boundary conditions. So it's one thing we should look at. And it's interesting also in ADS5, we have this tachyon that is annoying us, but it's four-dimensional gravity, so we should have a closer look. So maybe we can deform it, and we have a few tunable parameters, and we can see if we can get rid of this tachyon just with tuning this parameter as we have done for the three dimensions. And I have other things to see, but I will stop here. Thank you for your attention. Yes?
In the ADS5 case, we found that by preserving around flat space on the boundary, you get this stability.
Yes.
Do you think you can check what happens if you introduce a small or small piece of molecular
constant? So, Hawking, Hertog, and Will have done that. They were very close to that. So they also look at it was in these brainwave scenarios where there was a UV cutoff, and they look at some the seeded space in four dimension where you can tune all these parameters I've shown before here. So they played also a bit with all these parameters, and they found that in some sense the result very very close to that, and adjusting some parameter you can get rid of this annoying tachyon, but you get another one because of the De Sitter space. So it's still unstable, but you can control this instability by adjusting the parameter such that the decay is very slow. So one good hope is to look at some negative cosmological constant at the boundary. So to have anti De Sitter space at the boundary. Because there also, ADS usually works. So So maybe in that case we can get rid of the Kirk more easily. But we have to look at more closely if we, because that's the interesting case also, to have the Sitter space and to describe it by some dual theory. So definitely we should look at that in detail.
If you turn down the coupling, you cut coupling, and you get gravity coupled to a large number of Q cubes. Now, this is something people are studying. I know Andy has problems with the overall domain defining gravity. Do they have similar issues? Does that work? Like couple gravity to a large number of Q cubes may induce an action.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a sensible point of view?
I don't know. Really?
In four dimensions, it's very hard to compute the role of mechanism. Now, in some sense, we reproduce some of that calculation here, which is maybe the SCAP method. And naively, if you just study curved around flat space, the answer is no. You get these ghosts that Jeffrey shows.
And was that found, do you know if that was found by people who did it in couple?
But they did everything.
But it's one of his first papers. First paper was a large dimension. But he looked at induced gravity with large numbers of massless cubes.
But everything was at one loop, I suppose. It was weak. So it's very different than the point of range that we have here.
There's no reason that this ghost should be missed. You should have found exactly that ghost, and then probably stop with you since it's the same. But what's interesting is, I mean, I don't know when people look this seriously in the obvious, where it looks like it's much better behaved, and beautiful, apparent violin variance. In some sense, if you stuck with the pure violin variant theory, you didn't try to add a Einstein term, what could go wrong? Now, of course, once you add the Einstein term, it goes to the theory.
Any other questions?
Okay, thanks.